This week's episode of On Comedy Writing is brought to you by Handy. There's two things I want to get done this week in this ad, and that is I want you to use Handy. I also want to gain Twitter followers. My Twitter's at TheRealAskJ. Not a great Twitter handle, I know, but that's what it is. I'm gonna read some Handy copy, and then I'm gonna read a tweet of mine, and you know, maybe that'll leads you to do both. So Handy is a website where you can book top-rated home cleaners and handymen, friendly vetted professionals at your doorstep. Just pick a time and we'll do the rest. My tweet, I'm having problems with the second act of my screenplay. Oh, Jesus Christ. I'm getting a little nervous. You know, I don't like reading my tweets, but here you go. I'm having problems with the second act of my screenplay. The problem is I wrote the movie second act. Now, that's a reference to the Jennifer Lopez movie. You know, nothing against the filmmakers, just I think that looks kind of bad. That got one like on Twitter. So, Handy, experienced and background check professionals, easy online payment rescheduling, affordable and flexible cleaning plans, they have it all. Here's another tweet. I'm a writer, so yeah, I Google some pretty weird stuff. In case anybody's monitoring me, I sporadically Google, I'm a writer doing research for a project. Also, I'm responsible for every murder in Kansas City since 1991. Another tweet there. Kind of a long one. Definitely not 140 characters, but you know, Twitter's not 280, of course. So, I wasn't doing research for a project. And I guess I also didn't murder anybody. So two retweets. One of them was the On Comedy Writing account. That's how I control that, so that doesn't really count. So really one retweet and eight likes. Request your favorite professionals. Every cleaning is insured, cleaning supplies included. They also do furniture assembly, interior painting, hanging pictures and shelves, TV mounting, plumbing, electrical handyman, and more. And I guess one more tweet here. So in kind of a an asterisk thing, you know, as it suggested, this is like preamble. Okay, for this joke to work, you have to know the television show Adam Ruins Everything, and you have to pretend that Adam Conover is having gay sex with me. So that's the end of the preamble, and then it says, Adam ruined my ass. Eight likes. Yeah, not really proud of that one. So, book a cleaner today and save by going to boardwalkaudio.com/handy. That's boardwalkaudio.com/handy. Follow me on Twitter.
This is a Boardwalk Audio podcast.
On comedy writing, on comedy writing.
Thanks for downloading this episode of On Comedy Writing, the podcast about the business and craft of writing comedy. I'm your host, Alan Johnson. We've got a great episode, but first, the best way to support this show is by going to boardwalkaudio.com/oncomedywriting. Click the Support Our Artist button, shop on the Amazon if you really would. We get a little kickback. This is the last episode of 2018. I'm taking 2 weeks off, so the next episode will be out on January 9th. So just try to get through the holiday season without your On Comedy Writing fix, you know, without one of my brilliant sketch pitches to get you through the break. Our guest this week is David Angelo. He's a stand-up that regularly performs at the Comedy Cellar. He's written for Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, and he's currently a writer at The Daily Show. So here is David Angelo. David, thanks for coming to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Massachusetts.
Okay. What part of, is it close to?
Close to Boston.
I guess that's the question everyone probably asks, right?
Yeah, but not Boston. Yeah. But close to Boston. And a lot of people come from there. A lot of comedians come from, every comedian comes from Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, Florida, or Illinois. You ever notice that?
Connecticut seems kind of random to me in that list.
No, a lot of people come from Connecticut.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you think that's because, I guess those are richer states? Is that true? Is that a thing?
I don't know if they're richer states.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true.
Because you don't really get a lot of, You get some out of Maryland. Maryland's a small state. Florida, I wouldn't characterize as a rich state. I guess maybe it is. Yeah. I just think I don't know what the pattern is, but that's true. There's very few people from other states. You'll have those other examples, but the majority, I would say 80%, are New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Florida, Illinois.
Huh. I'll have to keep that on a look at now. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Did you like growing up there?
What's that?
Did you like growing up in Massachusetts?
Yeah, no, it was fine.
I don't know. Yeah. Does anyone like growing up anywhere? Does it change for anyone?
I don't know. What do I know? That stuff I don't know about.
Did you like comedy growing up?
Yeah, of course. Let's see. I watched some comedy. I watched a lot of. They had at that time. They had. They were inventing syndication for cable.
Mm.
So, or maybe they weren't inventing it, but they had. It was kind of new. So there were a lot of older shows that you could watch. That were maybe more kid friendly. Then, because I watched The Cosby Show and stuff like that, but not the most of the comedy shows I was watching were like the older, like I Love Lucy kind of thing.
Mm.
That was a big show. You know, a lot of people say women in comedy and all this stuff. I mean, most of the comedians when I was a kid, it was like Carol Burnett, Lucille Ball, Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, these were the shows that were on. These were the ones I watched. So they were kind of, it was more women than men in some cases.
Do you think Lucille Ball and stuff, you think that like holds up at all today?
I haven't watched it in a long time, but yeah. I think it does.
Because it's a lot of physical bits, right? Wasn't she like a physical?
It's situational. It's just very prototypical sitcom.
Okay.
And it's good. I mean, those are the four of them were all really good. The neighbors and the husband.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a cast of four, and they put out a lot of different comedy scenarios, and it's actually pretty good. I think you should watch it. It's one of those things. I just watched. I don't watch a lot of TV, but I watched Big Bang Theory mm-hmm. for the first time over Thanksgiving. And it's the same thing, you know, but this is now, because I Love Lucy, God, it must have been 1955 or something like that. It was really early. So it hasn't changed that much. And if this is people who listen to this, are trying to be writers, I'd actually go back and look at it because it's a little more basic and you can see what premise stuff works.
Like story structure wise, you're saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those half hour multicams seem like incredibly difficult to write in terms of like jokes. You have to do like a joke, like three jokes a page or something, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't do a lot of, I don't write that stuff, but I don't know the breakdown, but if you watch I Love Lucy, more than Mary Tyler Moore show, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm trying to think of like other sitcoms that are just like, they're like the textbook sitcoms that everything else kind of bases themselves off of. People love Cheers. Cheers is another big one. But those kinds are really good.
Yeah. I saw the Mary Tyler Moore pilot not too long ago.
Yeah.
And it was really funny.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's... I don't think she was necessarily... Oh, that was another show. It was Dick Van Dyke, which is more the family thing, because Lucy didn't... I think they had kids in the last season or something, but it was really about these two couples, which made it more like Big Bang Theory. You know, it's kind of like... We look at them as old people, but they were kind of like the young, I mean, they were old in the that show too, but I guess, you know, that's more of that dynamic of like the singles and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then Dick Van Dyke show with Mary Tyler Moore. I never thought she was like super funny, but the show was pretty good. And she was good. She had like a role. She was more like a character actress, I feel like. She kind of had one note more than Lucille Ball, I felt like, was a little more dynamic. Mm-hmm. And that Mary Tyler Moore show's Workplace prototype. And then all the other shows, Murphy Brown, News Radio, those are all like derivative of that. Mm-hmm.
When you were growing up, were you doing like any writing or performance stuff like at school or anything?
No, not really.
Yeah.
No, when I was in school, everybody I felt like was so funny. And I think they were funny. I think 16-year-olds are very funny, even like wherever they are, anywhere. I think they're very funny. They get like how to be like jokesters and stuff. It's just not as necessarily comedy that plays to a mass audience.
Sure, yeah.
But they're funny. You know, when they like make fun of each other and stuff, they're like as funny as anybody.
People say that, I think I heard someone say like, you're never funnier than you are like with your friends, like at the lunch table. Versus, like, you know, writing stuff or performing stuff?
Yeah, that might be true. Because it's more fun. It's fun yeah. plus funny.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas a lot of funny is just not fun.
There's a lot of funny teenagers in New York City, specifically. I guess you encounter them more than you would in other places.
Well, they're around more.
They're around more, yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. All teenagers are kind of funny.
Yeah. When you when you're looking at colleges, did you know what you wanted to do?
No, I didn't. I didn't have the thought that you could be a comedian, and so I didn't. I think that's really bold to be an 18-year-old and like I'm gonna be a. In work in show business as a, you know, I don't know. That's like really bold. It's too bold for me. Mm. And I think a lot of times that does not work out.
Right.
And then you're kind of sitting there with like, what is your backup? Because the problem is a lot of people are smart. A lot of people who like, when they're 18, like, I'm going to be a comedian. It's like, they could have easily been lawyers. They could have been doctors. But then they go in this path where it's like, you kind of fuck up these 4 years. Where you are kind of goofing around. Actually, and I don't think you should study comedy. I think that's another thing you shouldn't do. I don't know what the opinion of your other guests are, but I think it's better to just have like a some other kind of thing you focus on.
Right.
And then... Because I mean, sitting in a classroom and just like watching cartoons or something, like, I don't know what, I don't get it. And I don't get when people go to film school. I used to work in production too. You get nothing out of that. You can work in film if you are competent. That's it. That's the only qualification you need. Nobody cares if you went to college. Nobody cares. I think there's some like advantage maybe. If we're talking the real aristocracy and it's like you go to Tisch at NYU, and then, you know, like this woman, Lena Dunham. If you can, there's those paths, but that's not for everybody. That's for a few people who can be like, I'm at Tisch, and I just spent $50,000 on a short film that then got me, you know, the eye of producers because they're so impressed by how young I am. And like that kind of thing, yeah, I mean, but I don't, that was not... If you have money, like, yeah, go that way, but that's not the way to go. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you should plan that. If you're a spot, what is the point of this? Is people listen to this for trying to make it in writing?
Comedian.
I'm giving advice. I'm being Johnny advice here. Because I'm thinking like people listening who are like, I want to be a comedy writer.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying, that's why I'm like focusing my answers that way.
No, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Right. It is funny though that they have like those What's that in Chicago? They have like that Second City thing that's like part of a university. I think it's like comedy studies. I think you can get like a 4-year degree in comedy studies, which does seem absurd to do that.
Yeah, it does not work that way. It really doesn't. And the same with the film thing, I'm telling you. Just, you're better off, I mean, at the very least, don't pay anyone for that. You're better off just being like working right out of high school and then just trying to figure that stuff out on your own instead of going into debt, because there's nothing worse. Like, the problem is, what will happen is, and I'm speaking to middle class people, okay? I don't know who the viewership of this thing is, but like, if you go...
All upper class, everyone's extremely rich.
They honestly, like, I don't know.
They could be, I don't know. I don't know either.
So if you are a middle class person, you don't want to be the way it is now. It's like you leave 4-year university with $70,000 in debt or something. What do you think the average debt is? I don't know what it is.
Maybe even more than that, but yeah.
But if you have $70,000 in debt and then you're out on the, you're in the working life, the problem with comedy is like a nighttime thing, okay? And if you have a job because you have to pay $70,000 back with interest, and you're going to compound your obstacles that make it harder for you to do the actual comedy stuff. And the $70,000 albatross is a bigger hindrance than sitting in a classroom while some fucking person plays Looney Tunes cartoons. Although, which, by the way, are very funny, but yeah, like, you can do that on your own.
Yeah. So what did you end up doing?
I switched to TV production, which is like, and that's why I'm speaking from experience. Mm-hmm. It's, although, but I didn't take on a huge debt load, so it was a little different for me. But I was like sort of resolved around sophomore, junior year that I wanted to be in show business. I don't know necessarily stand up or writing, whatever, but. And I was maybe misled a little bit because I was good in the college scene for comedy. But in the professional world, I wasn't really, like, ready. But I thought, you know, well, hey, I'm this, whatever. So anyway, I did change to TV because it was kind of the easiest thing to get through. And I thought it was relevant. And it did, you know, it did in some ways after I left college because I knew how to do a lot of tasks and things. And I was familiar with certain equipment and that I worked in some production stuff, but I didn't need to do that to get those jobs. And I don't necessarily think it helps. It just was what I was already focused on. So that's what I pursued.
And what college did you go to?
George Washington University.
Okay. And so were you doing like stand up in college?
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. And I wasn't very good, I don't think, but
What made you want to do stand up?
It's the only real path to career stuff. Improv, honestly, like I did improv, it goes nowhere. It's like a total waste of time. Maybe if you're like more of an actor, like I do have some friends who are very good performers. I'm not a good performer. But they are really good performers, and I think that helped them. But like again, we're talking like 0.001% of these people who go through that stuff, and they you could say before they went into improv that they were already great performers. So it wasn't like too much of it changed. But you have a real hard time with improv when you're a real adult because you can't get you can't get teams together as easy. People have scheduling conflicts, all this stuff. So you're beholden to this team to do anything. And that's very hard, especially at the early stages, because people are not really that committed. And at least in stand-up, you can go by yourself. And it's still kind of the one that matters more in Hollywood.
Well, especially today, I feel like maybe there's like an improv boom, improv and sketch boom, like maybe a couple of years ago, but now it's definitely back to stand up.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, improv is kind of going away.
Yeah,
I feel like UCB, like they just fell off the mat.
Yeah,
but
literally because they moved to like the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, they didn't. They They don't have the clout they did. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not. I'm not saying don't do it, but like, I wouldn't plan a career through that.
So when you left college, where'd you go?
I moved to Chicago, and that's where I didn't have money to go to New York. I don't know how, and that was then. I don't know how people do that now. And I moved to Chicago. And I, at that point, stopped doing improv altogether. I never did improv in Chicago. And there was a big comedy scene there. And a lot of people, it was kind of like an anomaly. It was one of those things where everybody was really good. And a lot of them, of the core group that I hung out with, there was a huge success rate on, you know, millionaire comedians right now. Which I don't think most scenes would get. So there was something unusual that it just was right place, right time. Kind of a bizarre thing. Which was lucky, I guess.
Would you recommend to people to start out in Chicago rather than a New York or LA?
I wouldn't change anything about what I did because I had that one weird anomaly of a scene, which I don't think exists anymore. And I also didn't have the money. But if I was 21 now and I had the money, I'd go to New York. I just don't see. You know, you could. The argument is always try to go get better in Chicago or whatever, and then you come to New York or something. But I mean, I did that, but and then I moved to New York. Nobody cares. It's like you're at zero anyway when you move here. So you might as well just come here and save the time. And I think the bar being a little higher in New York would force you to develop a little quicker, too.
Why New York over L.A.?
Well, L.A., if you're really beautiful and you are... you're someone who can be an actor, you know, I could see maybe something there. But LA is very saturated. It's very hard to like stand out there, and you have to stand out against all the stars. There's not a lot of stars in New York. You know, I mean, you can run into Aziz or Chris Rock at the Cellar or something, but you know, you go to LA and it's like there's stars everywhere on all those shows. So it's hard. You have to compete with them. You have to compete with these people who are all beautiful and all this kind of thing. It's just harder to stand out in. And it's not quite as funny of a place to live. New York is funnier, especially if you're young and you live in kind of like dire circumstances and things. It's a little more of a. It's a little funnier. And I also think it makes a better story. Remember, you want to write a story for your life, you know? And it's better to be like, and then I moved to New York and it was miserable than to be like, and then I moved to LA and, you know, I lived by the beach and, you know, like people, you don't get the right experience. I'm talking about stand up now. And I'm not great at whatever the advice is for writing. I don't know how to make it as a writer unless you're a stand up. I have no idea. I mean, I kind of have an inkling, but geez, that's like good luck.
Are you saying because like if you're not a performer, then it's hard to be known as a writer?
Yeah, because I don't know. You still have to make yourself famous somehow. I mean, at least you have to have notoriety in the scene. And I always see people when people are like, "I want to be a screenwriter," or something. It's like Jesus. You have to write the most perfect script that ever existed. And then you have to get it to somebody. They have to agree it's the most... I mean, the factors beyond your control. And that's assuming you're the best writer. There, you know, I don't know how those people... That's an episode I'd listen to because I don't know how they even do that.
Yeah, it is wild because, I mean, so few screenplays get made, especially comedy screenplays these days. It's like insane to think how you can make that transition to doing that.
Yeah, I have no idea. I think most people... at least pretend to perform, even if they're not, they don't have their heart in it. I think you kind of have to, it's the only way to market yourself, I guess.
So when you were in Chicago, are you just doing stand-up every night?
No, not every night. I don't believe those people. And I think they're frauds or something. I don't know why they'd say that. And I think it's ridiculous to do stand-up every night.
Well, it's part, kind of maybe part of the story thing that you're talking about. Like, they wanted, like, yeah, they're the hard worker.
It just sounds insane, though.
Yeah.
Because it's not hardworking. It's like ridiculous to be like, yeah, here I am with no act going up every night. Like, why? What are you doing? So I would go up. We did this. There was an open mic once a week. I think it was on Mondays. And might have been Sunday. I don't remember. But the kind of the whole scene turned out for that mic. And this is like the, now I've tried to go to the open mics more recently. They don't really exist like this. Right now, you go to an open mic, everyone's on their phone. We didn't have phones, you know. Everyone just kind of was. It was a scene. There's no good open mics anymore, which is a problem. That's why there's not a lot of good stand-ups. So we go to this open mic, and then there were some book shows. But the shows were kind of weak. The thing about other places beyond New York and L.A. is audiences are generally better because they have interest in being there. And in New York, sometimes an audience is just there to... I don't know what they're doing because they have to leave their house or something. I'm opening a bottle of water if you hear noise.
Well, I guess a lot of people in New York or L.A. are also comedians.
What do you mean, a lot of people?
Well, I mean, like, audiences are full, or sometimes...
Maybe, but not every night. In the open mics, yeah. They're all comedians, but we were all kind of comedians in Chicago, the open mic. But people paid attention and everyone watched, and like they were your friends too, and you'd kind of laugh at the things they'd say. And then you go out here, and I mean, I go to open mics if I'm on the road or something, and I'm just kind of like, because I'm, you know, when I travel by myself, I just want to go out and be around some people. And one of the nice things about doing comedy is you always kind of have a, it's like being a part of, you know, like Soho Club or like what's like a membership organization, you know, some membership organization. And you can go to any, it's like, oh, I'll go to the local comedy scene. And then you're kind of like a member of it already, even though you don't know anybody. Mm. But geez, you know, the open mics are the worst. And they, and in other scenes, like sometimes they're okay. So there's always like good people and bad people. But that's the hardest part of this business, is getting past that scene, which is so brutal to everybody.
What's your advice for doing that?
I don't know. I don't know anymore. I mean, look, I don't give stand-up advice because my stand-up career is an absolute disaster. I've never done stand-up on TV. I've never, like... I mean, I'm basically an open micer in stand-up, even though I've done it for a long time. So I'm not even pretending to give advice.
Well, how did you get past like doing open mics and like personally?
Well, when you're around, and look, the other thing is like my career is a disaster. I am good at stand-up, and I'm not like modest about that. I am like good at it. So eventually, you know, like in New York, I'm a regular at the Comedy Cellar, which is like the best. And that's like the best way to be. Those are the best shows in the city. But also, like, once you do that, like, people are more like, you know, willing to book you on a show because they like you have some kind of credibility or something. So once you get these little things start piling up, like maybe you'll be like, I'm going to a comedy festival, which none of them matter at all, but like. On those early rungs of the ladder, they kind of do. So, like, in your local scene, if you go to, let's say you're in, you know, St. Louis or something, and you go to the Boston Comedy Festival or something, which means nothing, but in St. Louis, the bookers there will be like, oh, okay, all right. I mean, this guy's not insane, maybe. So then they start to look at you different when you... send an email. So you have to do these little things, and then they pile up.
Mm. What brought you to New York?
I mean, this is where show business is. And I didn't, I, you know, I could have moved to LA, I guess, but most of my people I knew were here, and I don't know. I mean, I'm from the East Coast. It's just, it made more sense.
When did you know you're like ready to leave Chicago to go to New York?
I had been booked on every like good show there. And I felt like I was competent. I did a one-man show there, which I guess was like doing an hour, but you know, you have to kind of have a gimmick. And it went well, and I was surprised. I mean, I look back, if I ever saw a tape, which I don't know if I have a tape, I'm sure it's kind of a disaster, but the show went well with the audience, and it gave me a little more confidence. And it was like an hour show, and I'm like, you know, 23 or something. So it went well.
How'd you get hired for Fallon?
That was, it's kind of a complicated story. So the way it worked a little bit. So I never had for a little bit I had a manager and an agent, but at this time I did not have a manager or an agent. So these jobs are generally kind of, you're a little bit excluded from the process. But people would talk about it. So what they would do is, the comics, nobody would ever tell me. See, I tell every, this is why it's changed my, like, my approach with other comics. So I'm always telling, if I hear about anything, I tell everybody I do. Because I remember what it was like, and I try to help younger people who, you know, they don't have the same connections I do just because I've been here longer. Because it drives you nuts that it's, so much of it is all like, the hurdles are fake in a lot of cases, you know? So people wouldn't tell you about any jobs because they didn't want you to compete with them. They didn't want whatever. But they would start talking after that. They'd be like, so what happened was Jimmy Fallon was hiring a new monologue writer to replace Anthony Jeselnik, who left. And so they put out the word. Everyone made packets, and they were due on Friday. And nobody says a word until Friday. And then they were due. They handed them in. And then they're all talking about their packets. So I'm going around the scene. Everyone's like, oh, the Fallon. How's your Fallon? This and that. And I was like, why didn't anyone tell me about this thing? Like, I mean, because at the time I was writing a lot of like short jokes and everything like that. So I thought it would be a good fit to at least try. So I was really annoyed that nobody told me, and I hate that I'm outside of this thing, and I was frustrated. I didn't have a manager. I didn't have anything. So I just was like, you know, I don't care. I'm gonna write. I don't know what the packet is because they give you instructions and stuff and all this stuff. I don't even know what it is. I'm just gonna write 3 pages of monologue jokes, and I will get them to them somehow. And so I wrote the 3 pages that weekend, and then. I knew a guy. See, one of the things that helps you in comedy is by being around a lot, you'll eventually meet a lot of people. And so I knew a guy who worked at Saturday Night Live as like a producer for, he wasn't like a, you know, I don't think, I wouldn't call him like a big wig or anything, but like, you know, he was somebody at Saturday Night Live who I kind of knew for a few years. And I just emailed him or called him or whatever. And I was like, is there any way, here's this paper. You don't have to put your name attached to anything. Just put it, can you print it out and put it in the, on the desk of the reception desk? Just, you know, whatever. And then I'll roll the dice, see how it goes. And he did it because he wasn't a stand-up comic. He actually like had, he's a trustworthy person. So he did it. And then, I got hired from that, which shows, by the way, like these things about rules and like packets and stuff, they don't really matter that much.
Right.
People don't care. It's not, this isn't second grade where it's like, oh no, the packet was a day late. We can't hire this person. So they don't care about that stuff. And then, that's how I got that job.
What's your like general approach for packets when you get them like today?
Well, I don't really do packets anymore, but the last time I would do them, is, here's the thing with packets, okay? I've seen a lot of packets. They need to just be, you just need to show in one page, really. I don't know how long they're supposed to be, but you get, if you show on the first page, okay, here's a joke that's funny, and this person's not crazy. I mean, that's literally the bar. It's a lot lower than you think it is. And you need to be coherent, not crazy, and then, like, kind of keep things short. You don't want a paragraph. No one's reading paragraphs. You read a joke is two sentences. It's a setup and a punchline. That's it. So you should have at most 10 jokes on a page and just double space between the jokes. And that's it. That's all it is. For me, as someone, I know talk shows. I don't really know any other things that, like, you know, these weird format shows. I don't know that well, but I think to me it's the same. And if I was working at some weird show, I can't even think of it. I was going to say roast battle, but that's like I imagine that's a pretty straightforward packet of, like, just do some, put a name up at the top and then make insults about them. So I can kind of guess what that packet would look like. But at the end of the day, they just want someone where it's like, oh, wow, this is like a funny, like, you can get hired on like one joke. If you just have, the bar is so low. It is so, everyone wants to act like it's so the hardest thing in the universe. It's way, a lot of, and then look, this is a thing with acting too, I've noticed. When I lived in LA, this is what I noticed, is the attrition rate, or whatever, the success rate is really small in acting. Let's just say acting, so you know, and people don't get in their heads listening to me right now. It's very small in acting. But when you remove all the people who have no business even pursuing it, it's not that small. If you have any competency at the thing you're doing, it's not impossible for you to make it. The problem is in acting and in comedy, you have all these people who it's like, you need the Simon Cowell to come in and be like, you have no chance. What are you doing?
Yeah.
And the problem is that you don't have that really, and they don't take hints or they whatever. So there's a huge, it seems very hard to make it, but if you have any business doing it, it's not that hard.
It is actually, once you go to these places like New York or LA, you do see that there are so many fucking people who should not be doing this. Like, I saw, there's a guy I met recently who's like 45, and he's doing UCB classes, like acting classes, and he's like really bad at both. And it's kind of heartbreaking, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to do it when you're like just for fun, whatever it maybe is, but there's just a lot of, like, and I don't care if you pursue it, but honestly, like, it's a thing that discourages a lot of people when they're like, it's so hard to make it. And I'm just saying, like, if you are kind of good and you have any demonstrable skill, you'll probably be fine.
Yeah.
But the problem, you know, don't be concerned with, like, how hard it is to, how rare, and it's hard to, like, get a job in TV and whatever. And then there are people, by the way, who are so funny. There's a guy, I don't like the name names, but there's this guy, Casey James Salenko, and he is so funny. He's one of the funniest guys, and he's in New York right now. He's a stand-up. He's so funny. And I don't know professionally what's going on with him. I think he did he might have done a half hour on Comedy Central or something. But otherwise, I don't think a lot is happening with him professionally. And it's just with him and with other people this happens. You know, you kind of have to be patient because things don't just happen overnight for everybody. And so it's not necessarily a reflection of your skill because this guy's amazing. And you just kind of have to, like, wait it out a little bit. So I'm saying two things at once, which seem contradictory, but, like, the overall takeaway is, like, you know, if you can kind of do it, you'll probably be able to do it. And if you can't, you need a little bit of a self-awareness at some point to be able to walk away. And I think most people can make that decision. Mm-hmm. Just like you try to make it sooner than later.
It does seem though that if you are like good-ish and you stay at it for a while, it'll happen for you though. That seems to be like what happens for most people, I feel like.
Yeah, the people who stay in. I mean, most people I started with stand-up, everyone has better. My stand-up career is such a disaster, but they all have better. They're all done better than me in stand-up, and because they stuck around. And the people who didn't stick around, yeah, they leave. I mean, it's sort of self-explanatory where it's like, yeah, if they didn't make it, they didn't make it. But there's a lot of like, you know, they're not great. They're not great at all, but like they've been around long enough that they kind of forced a career out of it. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a little bit inspiring. It's like, you know, okay. So it's a little bit difficult. But I think if you have some skill, you should not be concerned with, you know, you might not make it right away, but you'll be all right.
And Fallon was your first TV writing job. What was that transition like to that job?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'll say this about, so I had grueling regular jobs before Fallon. So when Fallon happened, which is notoriously a very difficult TV workplace, it was not that crazy for me because I was working in Connecticut. I mean, I was doing like, my commute was like 4 hours a day. I mean, it was insane. So like for me to like go to from that to these things, it was not that big of a deal. But because I was working really intense stuff, because for me, it's like nobody gives me money. Nobody like, I had to do all this stuff. So I think that kind of helped a little bit. I do see people who get jobs in television and it's literally their first job. And then they implode because they don't even understand like workplace stuff. And they don't get like workload and that kind of thing where it's like, and for me at that point, and I was pretty young, but I mean, I had just crazy amount of like, it was like a relief to work 10 hours a day. It was a relief. So it wasn't that big of a deal to get into that.
How do you approach writing monologue jokes?
I mean, they're easy. Honestly, like it's kind of a formula. It's just like the setup is the summary of the clearest summary you can make of the story, and then the punchline is just, you know, how can you like tie it into some other thing or make some play off of these premises. I can't give a good example without an example of a story, but you know, it gets kind of formulaic. In the old days, I'll do it as the old days because then it's a little easier to process. But you know, if you had a story about China, this is the old days now. Don't get me in trouble with the PC police or whatever. But this is how it was. If you had a story about China, the jokes would be like how they eat dogs or the kids are in factories or, you know, there's like very like, you know, they slip menus under the door, like very, very lunch special stuff. That's how you would do it. You would just tie whatever the story was back to those references. It's very simple. I don't know. Like I can't think of a good topic, but it's like kind of mechanic. And then if you can come up with like okay jokes, and then the people who are really good at it can figure out how to do it in a little more surprising way. So it's like, oh, that's funny. Whereas it's not as expected punchline.
So you mentioned that, you know, that's how they used to do it in the old days. Do you think now that you can't, I guess people get more upset about like jokes about stereotypes and stuff. Do you think that makes it harder to write monologue jokes?
No, this is stereotypes. It's the same thing. There's just different stereotypes. I'm just using those examples because I can't think, I can't think off the top of my head what the newer ones are. And I don't really do monologue jokes per se like that anymore. So I don't know, but, it's the same thing where it's like, here's the like first, what do you call it? Like maybe like word associations. Mm-hmm. Someone actually wrote an article about this, and it was pretty much correct, where you like, you just, what are the things you associate with this topic, and then like, how can you tie it in to have some kind of surprising, you know, a surprising way. Mm-hmm. It sounds annoying saying this in the abstract, but I don't know. I can't think of any examples. The only thing that came to mind was China, because that was one where it's like, if these stories came up, it was just like a given. It would be about eating. Like, if it's like China, Disneyland, China, it's like, okay, well, then it's what's happening in Disneyland, China. Well, Disney, they got, I don't remember the name. They have a dog. It's called Pluto, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's like, so something about them eating Pluto. Like, that's it. I mean, honestly, that's it.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm saying these as, like, bad examples, but, like, that's the process, I think. It's like, because you need to be able to tie it into something people understand. So it's not necessarily, like, laziness. It's just kind of like, that's how jokes kind of work in the short term. And I'm using these bad examples just because they're the ones I can think of in my mind right now. And they're in my mind because I know that they're bad examples. Mm. So I'm not being like,
right.
I'm not trying to be like a jerk about it. I just can't think of other ones.
What prompted you to leave Fallon?
They fired me. And by the way, see, this is my problem in my career. It's like, I'll say this openly. I don't care. Everyone else in show business would be like, oh, you know, I had a creative, you know. And creative differences. I just felt like I don't want to go to a different... It's like, I don't care about this. And I think it's weird when people do that. I don't have a problem saying I was fired. Because it didn't really work out. It was like a year. You had some... You know, there were some conflicts. There were some things I didn't like about the jokes that they were doing. I wasn't necessarily great at, like, joke writing at that point either. I wouldn't say. But, I think it was a little unwarranted. The problem was they were always like trying to change things up. If they felt like it, the shows this week weren't that great, it was just easy for them to be like, well, fire this person and bring someone else in. It wasn't necessary. I didn't take it personally, and I still don't. And I would be, if I saw Jimmy Fallon in the street, I'd be like, hey, Jimmy, you know, I have no hang up about that. That's just the way show business works. That's why I think it's weird when people lie about it, when people aren't honest. They have weird hang ups. If you're lying about that, then there's something they're really like, but for me it's like, no, it just didn't play out that way.
Those late night shows also like fire people all the time, not just like Fallon, but all of them. Because you're on like 12-week contracts, right?
Well, that's newer. They didn't used to do that. If you worked for Conan when he had late night, I mean, you could be there. It was unusual to be fired. Mm-hmm. And I think the same with Letterman for a point. I mean, there's probably some spots they rotate out of people a lot, but I think it's weird to fire a lot of people because the problem is it makes the staff nervous. And I don't think that helps. They might have a theory that it's like it gets people on their toes or something, but I think it just makes people not funny because you're nervous all the time.
What do you do in between jobs to find the next one?
I don't know. I mean, things will happen. Like, you know, I know a lot of people, so you just kind of pay attention. Oh, this person got a TV show. I know that person. All right, well, let me go see what they have to say. That kind of thing. It's a little easier in LA to be between jobs because there's so many more, like, little shows that happen. Out here, there's only, like, 5 shows. I mean, and they're very, like, they don't really, like, trade people or anything. So it's kind of like you get your, you know, you don't, it's hard to jump around jobs in New York and TV, but in LA, it's a little easier. And there's way more shows. And they all get canceled and stuff. I've worked on a bunch of shows. They only last for a few weeks. But that's fine when you're, you know, if you're in LA and you want to be a writer, or whatever you are, right, or whatever. If you work 20 weeks a year, that's really great. That's enough. That's enough. 20 weeks.
And after Fallon, you worked on Love You Mean It with Whitney Cummings.
Yeah, what are you just going through the...
Well, I don't know. I got a list of things.
Yeah, that's one of those shows. It was on E!
Yeah.
And it didn't last long. We did like 10 episodes. She was working on her sitcom concurrently with that.
Wow.
And E! Is weird. Like, I don't know if they wanted the show or whatever. You know, they probably didn't. They probably wanted it canceled before the first one aired. So it's like hard to like get again, you know, work against that. I like Whitney Cummings a lot, though. I think, again... when we talk women in comedy, I mean, she's first of all, I think she gets a bad reputation because people were mad at her sitcom or something. It was easy to make fun of her, but she's really good at what she does, and she's very funny. So, I mean, that was a cool place to work, just to spend some time. I never met her before that, and I'm not friends with her, I'm not close with her or anything, but she's an interesting person and definitely someone to like look to for. I'm sure her advice is much better than mine, but she's, you know, climbed very rapidly, and it was not sometimes people become stars and you're like, why, what happened, who determined, you know, who, what agents at CAA decided this person was a star? But hers is like, she's just really like, the work ethic is insane. And she does so well on stage. I mean, she crushes in stand-up. She's very interesting. I don't know why she's not more of a figure, I think, in show business. You know, people look to Sarah Silverman and stuff and all that kind of... She's, like, I think, maligned a little bit. Or at least doesn't get the credit she deserves. And I'm saying that as I'm not necessarily her friend or anything. But, you know, I just think she's interesting.
Yeah.
Works very hard. Jeez. If you work that hard, I mean, you know, that's how you kind of have to do it to reach that success level she has.
So that show, I assume, was a lot about pop culture stuff?
That one wasn't really about pop culture. It was more like, kind of like I think it was about her stand-up topics, I guess. We talked a lot about, like, women's stuff, which was maybe a little... unusual for me, or like I had stuff I hadn't done necessarily before, but I don't remember really what the shows were about. I think it was more like her doing stand up, and then there were guests. You know, she did stand up at like a desk or something, and she wrote a lot of it too. Like, she, you know, she would come to us for like if we could like punch up things, but she kind of did a lot of it.
When you're working on the shows and you know, obviously as a writer on a show that you're not like the head writer or like someone in charge of, you're going to be writing for a lot of stuff that you don't necessarily want to do, or you wouldn't necessarily do on your own. So how do you like write for someone else and still like stay creatively satisfied and whatnot?
I don't know. I mean, I don't like answering that like right after me talking about Whitney Cummings.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant because you talked about how you wrote like women's stuff, which wasn't necessarily in your.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Let me try to like rephrase.
Yeah. Sorry. I didn't mean to put you in an awkward position.
It's well, okay. So, and I don't want to use her show as an example because there's others, but there's like I worked on Shark Week too, so it's like I don't care about sharks.
Mm-hmm.
So there's sometimes there'll be topics that are things I don't talk about or they wouldn't occur to me, but you have to make jokes about them. And, I don't think it's hard to get into that mindset. It's something like, it's a little bit more of like, it's, I guess the fulfillment is being able to do the thing, because it's for me to like be able to do a bit, and I can't think of anything from, I'm going to go back to Whitney's show, and I can't think of an example. So I'm sure it's like bizarre listening to me even talk about this without any kind of references, but if I could do if I could write a segment about like women's lingerie or something, and I'm not saying that that's a segment we did, but we probably did something on like some reference to some kind of thong or something. I don't know. I mean, that's unusual for me, but if I can get through it, then that's like an achievement because I don't know anything about that stuff. So it's like, if I could make something funny on a topic I don't really know at all, then that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It's not that hard. Again, I keep going back to that. It's like, it's not that big of a deal. People always act like, a lot of writers will pretend that's such a big achievement. It'll be like, oh, another person's voice. You know, you have to get in their head. And it's like, it's like simple. You just have to like reword stuff sometimes. But it's kind of like the same. What I mean, you know, you can have the same funny opinion on something. Like, I don't, you know, I'm not, like, for instance, all right, I did the White House Correspondence Dinner with Hasan Minhaj. I'm not Muslim, okay? I'm not an Indian Muslim, but like, on those premises, I could still come up with jokes. Because it's just like what my view of that would be in that. If I were, I mean, I don't know. It's not that hard. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to, like, explain it. It's just, people like to say it's a big deal because it makes it sound like what they're doing is more impressive. It's right. It's not that big of a deal.
What was it like writing for on that correspondence dinner? I guess that was the first year of Trump, right?
Yeah, I think. Yeah, it was 2016. No, what are you, no.
Oh, was it 2017? But it was like...
Oh, it was 2017, but he was inaugurated 2017. Yeah. Yeah, okay. It was fine. I mean, I'm not... I hate the media more than I hate Trump, to be perfectly honest. So most of what I focused on was the jokes about the media. And he wasn't there, and...
Yeah.
I loathe the people in that room. I think they're absolute scumbags. Like all those like cable news people and the
yeah.
So I went and it was a little weird being in there and like these people, these guys I absolutely cannot, like John Brennan, the CIA guy who's a totally unhinged, crazy person. Being around all these people was a little surreal.
But you currently work at the Daily Show. How'd that job come about?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I interviewed for it. I don't know. I don't remember the details.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. They just were like, come for an interview, and I interviewed them. That's all I remember.
You joined like right when the new show started, right? The Trevor Noah-led show.
Yeah.
What was it like relaunching the show with the new host?
Well, I didn't, again, I wasn't there for Jon Stewart, so I wasn't, to me, it was just like, here's the show,
mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that strange. Most of the shows I've been on were all started up new, like Fallon was only a year in, all the other shows in LA were all brand new when I joined, so wasn't that unusual.
Do you like writing about politics, comedy about politics?
Not particularly.
Mm-hmm.
It's very like, I'd much rather just be goofy. And I don't think you can do that when you talk about politics because you have to have some message, which I'm not into. I'd rather write for the Three Stooges, but that doesn't exist anymore.
It's weird how, the default now, like late night, is political. And so, kind of, it's, I guess, because of Trump, but it's like everything is very political now in late night comedy, which feels odd.
Yeah, I guess it is odd. I don't know.
Yeah. So, when you work on like a segment, how much are you thinking about jokes versus like some sort of like take? At the end of it,
I don't focus on takes like that. I don't do that, and it's pretty. You know, the takes are almost always obvious on the
mm-hmm.
political thing, where it's like, okay, what's the You know, and at the Daily Show, most of what I do is the first few minutes of the show, which aren't these political stories. So I don't really get involved in that too much.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with, like, breaking news, like, every day?
Well, any daily show, which most late night shows are, mm-hmm. deal with that. So they just, it's just, you know, you have, there's like 15 people there, you know, it's not that hard to be like, hey, we need one joke on this thing. It's not, you know, I'm saying it, I'm not trying to like discount the work that goes into everything, but it's not like a, alchemy, you know what I mean? It's not that difficult.
And so you've been at the show since Trevor Noah started as a host. How has it changed over, like, the years you've been there?
I don't know. The process is just a little smoother.
Mm-hmm.
He knows more what he wants to do every day. Maybe because, you know, part of it's him doing the show, part of it's him living in the United States longer. He kind of gets his point of view is more defined, so you don't have to, like, that's what I'm saying. I don't do takes. It's like he already has, like, the thing on it, so you just kind of follow the roadmap that he has, and it's a little easier now. He's more comfortable with the process.
What do you think the hallmarks are of, like, a good Daily Show segment?
I don't know. I don't know how to... That's for people to decide. I have no idea. That's not for me to figure out.
What would you like to be doing next?
I don't know. I have no idea. You know, you just want to have a job. That's it.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple. Pretty easy to... be satisfied in show business is if you have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, that's really rough.
All right, so we're going to wrap up with you giving your thoughts on a sketch pitch I have.
Okay.
And you just say whatever. So this would be a parody of, like, the part in the heist movies where they get, like, the gang back together. You know, like, when they have, like, the leaders, like, it's time to get the team.
Yeah.
So they're robbing, like, a Christmas ball. Something on Christmas Eve. They're robbing something on Christmas Eve. And so the guy's trying to get his team together, but everyone's just too busy during the holidays. They're like, yeah, sorry, I'm, like, going to be with my family. Or, like, if I book a flight now, it's going to be too late. Yeah, it's going to cost so much. So the whole sketch is, like, the main guy, like, being very, like, needy and trying to, like, text people to come do his thing. And they won't. They're all too busy with their, like, celebrating the holidays. So that's the idea.
It almost sounds like a TV commercial for, like, like a phone provider, like unlimited texting. You know what I mean?
I see.
And then just like how, because here's my feedback on this sketch.
Yeah, go for it.
You have this one joke, but it just happens the first time it happens. So soon as someone says, I can't, I'm busy, then every other instance of that happening is the same joke. Right?
I was hoping, like, I guess I was hoping there'd be, like, diversity in the same joke in terms of, like, so the first guy's like, oh, it's Christmas Eve, I'm, like, with my family. But the next guy's like, it's the holidays, booking a flight's going to be insane. It's going to be so expensive.
Right. But it's really the same joke. So you need to heighten that somehow. You almost need to be like, that's the premise instead of the punchline. The premise is you can't get anybody because it's Christmas. So then the joke is like, well, then he gets all these Jewish guys.
Right.
Or something like some team. I don't know what it would be, but like, but there needs to be some other like way to, that's the setup, I think.
Interesting. I guess that makes sense. It is a, yeah.
The premise is it's Christmas Eve. I can't get anybody. Then. But right now you have it as, I want to do a heist is your setup right now. And your your punchline is, it's Christmas Eve, there's nobody available.
Yeah.
But I would shift it the other way.
That makes sense, because it's more heightened up, and there's more room to go, more places to go.
Yeah, I think so. Because otherwise you're doing the same joke and it feels like a setup.
Do you think it could work if it was like quick? If it was like a quick, like maybe like 30-second sketch of like in and out?
Maybe.
If it was just like quick cuts to each person?
What you need to do is write it out.
Yeah.
You need to put it in a script form because even the way you're explaining it, you need to say there's a guy who wants to do a heist. And what is the heist that's happening on Christmas? It's some Christmas-related thing, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Right? I couldn't think of a Christmas. I was trying to think of a real-life Christmas thing. I couldn't think of anything that would make sense.
Yeah, and so then it's like, well, okay, this thing is happening on Christmas. They're not available. So who do I get? Like, that's the question that's being asked, mm-hmm. I think, to me.
Yeah.
I could be, but again, like, I could be wrong.
No, that makes sense, yeah. All right, anything you want to plug? Daily Show?
No, I don't plug anything.
All right, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Audio podcast. For more information and shows, visit boardwalkaudio.com. Don't forget to rate and subscribe now.